all of you who prayed for us as we went off to camp this week to enjoy a week of teaching on the assurance of grace and salvation was the topic of the week. We had a number of opportunities to hear about what it means to be assured and also to realize that there will be times we're not assured of our faith and our position. But the confession deals with all of this, and I had the privilege of preaching on the foundation of assurance, and my text was from Hebrews 10, as well as the first stanza of the solid rock. My hope is built on nothing less than Jesus' blood and righteousness. I dare not trust the sweetest frame, but wholly lean on Jesus' name. And so we had a great time together. I got no sleep. Because when you are in a cabin with 6 teenage boys, there's not much opportunity for sleep. But we did have some wonderful conversation and some bonding time and got to know a great deal about the families who were there. Keep that between us. And so we had a delightful time together. And I hope that that those who went along, the young folks that went with me also had a great time and that they came home and testified to their parents, and then they will testify to you about all that they experienced while they were there in the hope that you will send your children next year. So just put it on your calendar for the last week of June. It's typically either the last week of the June or the first week of July, depending on how it falls. So just plan to send your 12-year-old and older with us, and you're welcome to come along too as adults. We would certainly love for you to do that. Open your Bible then to Esther, the book of Esther, and this morning I would have you open to chapter 6. The direction of this book, as you remember, is to see how the book flows, if you will, is to note that chapters 1 and 2 are the sort of introduction or prologue of the book, in a sense, where Esther rising to become the queen of Persia is only in anticipation of what will come, chapter 3 being sort of the axle upon which the rest of the book will turn. The plot of Haman to destroy the Jews becomes the center of the book, and then the remaining chapters deal with how that is resolved. Chapters 4 to 7 outline the response to this edict, response by various individuals, and then chapters 8 to 10 becomes the resolution itself. So in a sense, what we're looking at here, as we did last week and we'll do again this morning, we're looking at how each of the main characters of the book responds to this edict that Haman has gotten the king to issue. How will they respond? Last week we looked at the response of Mordecai, Esther, and even Haman to an extent. But this morning we're going to look at the response of the king. How does the king respond to this edict? And I would argue that the response of the king here is the direct providence of God. The direct acting of God in time and space. We think of the sovereignty of God. We think of his utter rule over all things. When we think of his providence, we think of his sovereignty being worked out in time and space. How he himself acts in accordance to his will to accomplish what he wills. And these are two chapters, 6 and 7, that are filled with obvious examples of God working out the circumstances he desires to produce the end he wills. Now again, I know his name is never mentioned in the book, but I don't think you can read through chapters 6 and 7 and not see this grand providence of God at work, his invisible hand moving through circumstances to accomplish his will. Now, again, I hope that you had the chance to read the text. I'm not going to read all of it because I'd rather talk about it than read it. So I want you to see the flow of how this works. It says in the first three verses that the king could not sleep. He could not sleep. And you'll notice at the very beginning of the chapter, it says, on that night. Okay, so what it's referring to then is obviously the previous chapter is referring to the very night that Haman himself built the gallows upon which he planned to hang Haman. On that very night, the king could not sleep. Now, let me just pause here for a moment and note something for you. Here's what you're going to see, starting in chapter 6 and going through chapter 7. A series of twists and ironies and comedies, clearly orchestrated by God. A series of implied actions on the part of God. I know he's not directly mentioned, but a series of twists and ironies and comedies designed to fulfill his purposes. What's ironical, pardon the pun, here is that God is going to use irony and comedy and twists in time and space to accomplish what he wills. And the very first one is the very first words of the chapter. On the very night that Haman decides to build a gallows, the king is lying there with insomnia. Now, let me just, for a moment, just hold that thought. And I want you to think about something here. When we talk about twists and ironies and comedies, and we talk about God doing work of providence, and we talk about providence being the aspect of God's sovereignty whereby he works, we need to be careful. We need to be careful. We embrace the sovereignty of God, okay? We embrace the idea that God is ruling over all things. The vast majority of Christians do not, okay? Let's be clear about this. The vast majority of Christians do not believe that God is sovereignly and providentially governing this world. The vast majority of Christians believe in happenstance more than they believe in the sovereign actions of God. Because the reason they don't is because they don't believe that their destinies are other than them in their own hands. The vast majority of people, particularly in the West, believe their destiny is in their own hands. So if their destiny is in their hands, God cannot be sovereign. But we embrace the sovereignty of God. But when we do so, we need to be careful. We need to be careful that we do not become fatalistic. Now, what I mean by fatalistic is we must be careful that although it's central to the message of the gospel, and although it's central to the message of Christ, we must be careful that we do not become to the point of believing that God is simply governing everything and that every circumstance is happening simply because he's pulling the puppet strings. And that everything is being governed by God in some sort of way in which we're all just marionettes just flicking around on the strings. That's not the picture of sovereignty that we believe in. That's a straw man that many will paint of what we believe, but it's not. What we believe is a compatibility between the will of God and the will of men. Or let me put it this way. The consequences here that are about to take place in this chapter are brought about as much by the poor choices of the players as they are by the super intention of God. God superintends, yes. He decides all of what's going to be, but that does not mean that we are simply marionettes on a string. We have will. God has granted to us volition as a part of the image of God that he's put within us. We make choices. We make choices. And we are given by God the opportunity to make those choices. In this chapter, although we have a whole lot of things which look like God is simply making things happen, we must not ever get to the point of thinking that these things are happening simply because God is like puppet strings making all these people act. There are choices being made by these individuals, and they're acting. Those choices are compatible with God, what God wills. Now, this is a very difficult concept, I understand. It's beyond our comprehension because in this world, we don't have any other analogy of that in our own lives. God's will does not supersede our will, and yet at the same time, it is governed by his will. We believe that. We embrace that. Let me just state it more simply. The sovereignty of God does not excuse our sinfulness. We make sinful choices. We will choose sinful directions and sinful actions, even though those sinful choices and their consequences will be a part of the larger decree of God. No one will be able to stand before God and say, "You made me sin." No one will be able to say that, because we will make choices. And those choices will be entirely in our will of volition. It's very important for us to understand this. Yes, we will see God acting in these chapters as though he is making things happen, but the people involved are responsible for their actions at the same time. All right, so having said that, the king has a night of insomnia, and it begins the flow of the story. The very night that Haman builds his gallows, this king cannot sleep, and so he calls for someone to bring him his diary, the Chronicles of the King. Apparently, he believed his own exploits written in this book would act as a sleeping aid. What a boring life this guy must have. So he reads, and as he is reading, providentially, he reads about the specific event related to Mordecai. This takes us back to chapter 2. Remember I said that the first two chapters are sort of the setup to get us to where we need to go. So what happened to Esther and what happened to Mordecai, remember specifically Mordecai revealing the plans of two men who wanted to assassinate the king. Those events become something that leads to the resolution. So now the king reads of what had happened, that Mordecai had revealed this plot of Bigthana, Bigthan, and Teresh to assassinate the king. So he reads of this, and he's curious. What have we done for this guy? What have we done for this Mordecai? Because he saved me from a plot. What have we done? What kind of honor have we bestowed upon this man? Seems like a reasonable question. I find it fascinating also that no honor has yet been given to Mordecai. It's almost as though he's been overlooked. I would think that the first thing that a king would want to do after a man reveals a plot is to elevate this man, give him some reward for this, but it's been overlooked. Now, again, I would call that the providence of God, God's purpose, that Mordecai would not receive some reward. I can almost imagine Mordecai's thinking, how come I haven't gotten any sort of special treatment for the fact that I revealed this plot? How come if the king over... What have I done wrong? You can almost imagine. But it's all part of the larger plot. Why the oversight? The answer, of course, is so that the how and by whom Mordecai is honored will serve the purposes of God. Okay? It's not only the how, but the by whom. Okay? So we'll see that as we go. Now, let me also remind you of the fact that Mordecai's revelation, when he said to the king, these two men are trying to assassinate you, that came before he refused to honor Haman. Okay? Remember, he revealed that first, and then Haman was elevated to a position of becoming viceroy or prime minister or whatever you want to call him. And it's at that point that Mordecai says, I'm not bowing down to you. So that order is significant. Now we're looking back upon it in reverse. Mordecai's revelation comes before he refuses to honor Haman. So this is a recollection of an event that was precursor to it, that was prior to it. So the king reads of this exploit. Now, notice verse 4. Haman walks in. At just the right moment in time, Haman shows up at the court. Now, why is he there? Why has Haman come to this place? He comes because he wants the king to give him permission to hang Mordecai. Remember, he's come on the very night that he's built a gallows. He has the intention of having this Mordecai killed because he won't honor him. So he goes out, he has some men build a gallows in his backyard, and then he says, okay, now I'm going to go off to the palace and I'm going to visit with the king and I'm going to get permission. So notice how the two things come together. Haman comes because he wants Mordecai killed. The king is reading about what Mordecai's done, that he deserves to be honored. And when those two things come together, you have the immovable object meets the irresistible force. Boom. All right, this is how this is set up. Look, you can't make this stuff up. Now, you'll notice that when the king comes in, when Haman comes into the king's palace, he says, who's in the court? Haman had just entered the court to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai. And the king's young men told him, Haman is here. He's standing in the court. And the king said, come on in, come on in. So Haman comes in. And the king then immediately begins to speak. Now, notice that the king doesn't really care about why Haman is here, which I also find kind of funny. I find that kind of funny because here's a man who's been having insomnia, right? So it's sometime after dark, he's sleeping or trying to sleep, and all of a sudden Haman shows up. I think the first question out of my mind would be, why are you here at this time of night? But the king doesn't care about that. The king's only concerned about his own situation, his own thinking, and so he immediately begins to ask some questions. What should be done to honor a man in the kingdom worthy of honor? Okay? Now, he's talking, remember now, let's not forget, he's talking to a man who is his viceroy for all purposes, right? This is a man who he has elevated to a position of great importance. So he's talking to his number two, if you will, and he says to him, what are we going to do about honoring a man in the kingdom that's worthy of honor? That's the right question that you would ask this guy, because you know this guy is going to be the one who's going to do that. It's his responsibility. It's his job to do these sorts of things. And so the king immediately asks this question of him. Now, we know, of course, that the king is talking about Mordecai, but Haman assumes the king wishes to honor him. Look, if there's anything you know now about this man Haman, it's the arrogance of the man, right? Notice how the arrogance of this Haman exudes out of this book. It oozes out of this book. When you read about this Haman, almost every time you read him, every time you find some section of the book, it's all about him and how important he is, right? He is the one who arrogantly believes that everyone should bow down before him as a god. Mordecai said, forget it. But Haman says, well, if you won't bow down to me, then I'm going to kill you. The arrogance of the man to think that he's even a god. He arrogantly believes that Esther is honoring him by inviting him to her feasts. He arrogantly believes that the king is thinking about him all the time, even here at night. He walks in and the king suddenly says, what should we do to honor a man? And the arrogance of the man says, oh, he's talking about me. Oh, isn't that special? Oh, what is he going to do for me? Now, let me point out something to you here. This is real and hits close to home. And here's how it's real and close to home. Unregenerate men spend their lives thinking about themselves. Brother Carey this week, when he was preaching, he said something I found fascinating. It's very true. Now, I'd thought of it before, but really the way he said it brought it home. I don't know if I can say it as well as he did, but he said, basically, we spend all of our lives talking about and thinking about ourselves. Even when we sit down to have a conversation with somebody else, we want to talk about ourselves. We will turn the conversation to ourselves. Oh, we might ask a question. He called it a dishonest question. He said, we might ask a dishonest question about something about them, but we'll use it in order to turn and talk about ourselves. That's what unregenerate men do. It is the natural inclination of the unregenerate man to be thinking about himself and to assume that everyone else is thinking about him too. That everybody else is thinking about me. I'm God. And everybody loves me and me alone. What the fall did in the garden was to turn humanity into self-absorbed creatures. That's what we are. We love ourselves. We love ourselves. We overlook our flaws. We're under-concerned about what is wrong with us. And we are so self-absorbed in ourselves that we cannot look beyond ourselves to see someone else. We're selfish because we're self-absorbed. Our selfishness is not because we're naturally selfish. Our selfishness is because we're naturally self-absorbed. It's all about me. What can I get? Who can provide for me? What value do I have? Notice how that is so very rank in our culture. And I mean rank in the sense of a stench. The rank self-absorption of people in our culture. It's all about me, 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 everywhere you go. It's all about people saying, it's my way, it's my identity that matters, you see. And this is what's going to be the downfall of our culture. Because you can't have 330 million self-absorbed individuals all clamoring for the same stuff. Namely, themselves. True believers, those who are followers of Jesus Christ, think about Christ. They think about Him. They're not self-absorbed. They're Christ-absorbed. The Bible commands us to meditate upon our God day and night. Why? Because He's the only one worthy of our meditations and our thoughts. When we are self-absorbed, we become inherently selfish. We become inherently turned inward to ourselves, where it's all about us. But when we become followers of Christ, that nature within us to be self-absorbed is turned outward. And the Spirit of God turns our eyes and our hearts and our minds to this Christ. He is the object of our affections, not us. We look at ourselves and we see sin. We look at ourselves and we see error and darkness and blindness. And so we turn out to this Christ. Probably the greatest statement on this I see anywhere in Scripture is after Paul spends half a chapter talking about his own selfishness and his desires to do only what his flesh desires, he turns and says, "Who will rescue me from this body of death?" And what does he do? He turns away from himself. Praise be to this Christ who will rescue me. See, that's what the true followers of Christ is someone who is concerned about something other than themselves. Because listen, folks, anything you worship other than Christ is an idolatry. Anything you worship, anything you give attention to is an idol. We are commanded right at the very beginning of the Decalogue not to make any sort of graven images or have any sort of idols because anything we look to is going to be an idol if we're not looking at Christ, if we're not looking at God. And we are idol. We are little idol factories. We are little idol makers. It's fascinating. At the end of 1 John, you read through the whole letter, all about the love of God, and the very last words, keep yourself from idols. Isn't that fascinating? No mention of idols any other time. But the opposite of love of God is idolatry of some other kind. We keep our eyes fixed upon Jesus Christ. We turn away from looking at our selfish little selves and we look to this Christ. We see Him in His beauty. We see Him in His majesty. We see Him in His glory. We see Him in His perfections. We see Him in His love. We see Him in His work of the cross. We see Him. We see Him. We see Him. Stop focusing on you. Focus on Him, because that's what true believers do. Haman is a man who looks only at himself. We must be something different. Haman, ironically then, lays out what he believes should be done to him. Okay? I mean, the next little part is about, hey, this is what we do to honor the man. Okay? Now, listen to what Haman says that should happen. First, go get the royal robes and a crown and put it on the man. Now, notice what he says. Go get robes that the king himself has worn. You see that? Don't just go get something out of the closet. go get something that the king himself has actually worn. Okay, so there's a sense in which Haman is saying, well, hold that thought. And then go find a horse that the king himself has ridden on at some point in the past. And put the man on the horse. Clothe him in royal robes that the king has worn, and put him on a horse that the man, that the king has ridden on, and then find a noble official, one of the king's own men. Okay, see it? One of the king's men, someone who has been close to the king, has been near to the king, and have that man guide the horse through the city. And as he does so, shout about the man in the city square, thus it shall be done to the man who the king delights to honor. What is he saying? What is he saying? He's saying, treat this man as though he is the king. Do you see Haman's aspirations here? What does he really want? He knows he can never really be the king, okay? Because he'd have to kill Xerxes to get there, and it's not going to happen. But he can get close. He can wear the very robes that smell like the king, right? He can ride on the very horse that the king himself sat on. He can be led around the city by a man who was close to the king, and the guy who guides him around can shout, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. He's going to be elevated to a position of royalty. Now, Haman's already the top guy in the land under the king, is he not? But, of course, we know that we're never satisfied with where we are. In our selfishness, there's always got to be something more and something better. And so Haman tells the king, this is what you need to do, under the assumption, of course, that he will then be treated to another great elevation. Right? He's going to get promoted. Another great elevation that he's going to receive by virtue of his honor. Haman expects to be treated by the king as though he were the king. Now, let me point out something if you haven't figured it out already. Thinking of himself as equal to the king is what gets him killed. Arrogance only goes so far. The king will eventually see Haman as a threat as he rises up, but just keep that in mind. So the king, listening to Haman lay out this great honor, turns to Haman and says, then go and do all of that too. And he can almost see it. Mordecai. Go do all that to Mordecai. Let me make two observations here, if I will. Can you imagine the utter humiliation that Haman must be feeling at this particular moment? He came in for a reason. What was his reason? To have this Mordecai killed. You can almost see God going. He comes in to think that Mordecai, I'm going to get rid of this Mordecai, I'm going to kill this Mordecai, I'm finally going to get rid of this man who won't bow down to me as a god. And in fact, what really happens is he now has to go out and lead this man through the city and shout about his greatness while he wears the robes that the king himself has worn and rides upon the horse that the king himself has ridden on. What humiliation. But you know what? This is what will happen to every single person who rejects Christ. They will experience utter humiliation. The depth of humiliation that Haman is feeling here, I'm not sure that we can really grasp. Really? Try to put yourself in that situation. Try to imagine, if you can, try to be as arrogant as Haman and then turn around and have this man, this king, order your own enemy to be elevated by you. There's really no way to really appreciate that humiliation. I don't think anybody here has probably ever experienced anything even close to it. But that's what all who reject this Christ are going to experience, a humiliation. where the honor that they think is due to them is removed permanently. And there's never a possibility of it. Because everybody in this world, selfish little unregenerate reprobate men, are running around thinking to themselves, I'm going to be someone great, and I'm going to be someone special. I'm going to be someone who is going to have power and position and honor and glory and all these sorts of things. And I don't care about this God. All I care about is getting those sorts of things. And then the day is going to come when they pass from this life and stand before their judge, and he casts them away into outer darkness where there will be no possibility of any of that for all time. Utter and complete humiliation. But here's the second observation I'd make in this regard. Why doesn't this humiliation, this great humiliation, drive Haman away from his arrogance? Why doesn't it change Haman at that moment? Why doesn't it have the effect of making Haman go, maybe I'm too big for my own britches. Maybe I need to step back here. Maybe I'm missing something here. Maybe I'm going about this wrong. I mean, this Mordecai guy, I hate him with all of the fiber of my being because he won't bow down to me. Maybe I need to rethink that. Maybe I'm hating the wrong guy. Maybe I'm hating and I should not. You can almost see it. Haman leading Mordecai around on a horse, right? He's walking in front of the horse, leading the horse through the city square, shouting at the top of his lungs, as the king has said, thus let it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. You can almost see this humiliation, like drops of sweat off his head. This look on his face. But it doesn't seem to change him, does it? In fact, you'll notice at the end of the section that he goes back home and he whines to his wife. We'll get to that in a second. But it doesn't change him. It doesn't have any effect. Jesus himself said, even if someone should rise from the dead, they won't believe. Why? Why is it that human beings are so utterly stubborn that even in the midst of massive humiliation, they will not bow? Here's why. The same sun that softens wax also serves to harden clay. Same sun that softens wax also serves to harden clay. God's goodness to this man, and this was an act of goodness. You might not think so at first glance, but it was. This was an opportunity for God to say to Haman, back off. Step back. Do what is right. Go to the king and have the edict reversed. But instead, it actually turns to harden him. And one of the most key and significant realities is this. The grace of God turns the hearts of the elect to him, but the grace of God also hardens the sinner in his sin. In a sense, it is as though God's mercies upon people only serves to make them harder to him. This is the nature of rebellious human beings. We scratch our heads and we wonder, why is it that people can hear the word of God? They can hear the gospel preached to them. They can have a plethora of Bibles available to them. They can have churches all around them. They can have believers in their lives. And yet, the more they encounter those things, the harder they become to the gospel. And the answer is because God, in his inscrutable ways, makes his grace actually harden the hearts of the reprobate. The response of the unregenerate man to the goodness of God is to hate God more. To hate God even more. Which should make us, as the elect of Christ, throw ourselves upon the ground in front of this God and say, thank you for rescuing me. Thank you for taking out that heart of stone and putting a heart of flesh, because your grace would have done nothing more than harden me against you for all eternity. This is the essence of our worship. This is why we come into the sanctuary and we sing unto the Lord. And this is why we read His Word and sit under preaching, because we say, thank you, O God, that you did not leave me in that. What a horrendous thing that is to be hardened by the grace of God. Haman goes home. Verses 12 to 13. No, he sulks home. Depressed, ashamed, defeated, worried. His wife and his friends hear the story, and they wisely observe something. They wisely observe something. They observe that the king has now raised Mordecai to a position of honor greater than Haman. They observe that the king has elevated Haman, has elevated Mordecai, and by extension has lowered Mordecai. Although not directly, of course. The king hasn't specifically said anything negative towards Haman at all. He doesn't know any of the thinking process that's going on in the mind of Haman, right? He does not know of the gallows. He does not know of Haman's hatred to Mordecai. All he knows is that he wished to honor Mordecai, so he elevated him to a position of honor. Therefore, his wife says to him, therefore, the plot that you have hatched against him may now boomerang on you. See it? End of verse 14. And verse 13, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people. Okay, so that's clearly a reference to the feeling that Haman has towards the Jewish people, not just Mordecai. Okay, it's an allusion to the edict. If he is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. Might I suggest that those words are as much about the sovereignty of God as Mordecai's statement was when he said to Esther, maybe you are in this position at such a time as this. I would argue that these words are just as revealing of the sovereignty of God, just as, there's another word I want to use I can't pronounce. Just as revealing. Prescient. Just as prescient of God's work here than even those words were. And this is coming out of the mouth of a woman who does not know Yahweh. She has no knowledge of Yahweh. She's the wife of the man who wants to kill the Jews, so she's sympathetic to him. But now she realizes, wait a minute, the circumstances are such that you may very well now be in mortal danger from your own edict. By implication, then, I think what Zeresh is saying to her husband is you should do whatever you can to prevent the destruction of the Jews. Because he's a Jew whom you've plotted to wipe out, the king could potentially see that as a disloyalty to him. Having honored him, having honored Mordecai, and destroy you. Now, let me just pause here for a moment and note another great irony that you might not have noticed here. The other great irony is that although the essence of the statement is true, the source of the danger is not Mordecai. The source of the danger is Esther. She is the Jew
that will ultimately take down Haman. But Mordecai is connected. So, Zeresh looks to Mordecai and sees him as the object of threat against Haman, when there is another threat that has not yet been revealed. Because remember, nobody knows yet that this Esther is in fact a Jew. Now, they may have deduced it by virtue of the fact that she's connected to Mordecai. But there's no indication anywhere in this text that the king even knew that connection, that she was the cousin. There's no indication of that. So the real threat is still yet hidden to Haman. And I think the implication of this is, Haman, this is the wife speaking, Haman, you better back away here. You better back away here. But of course, he does not. Which leads to another tremendous sovereign moment. The last verse of the chapter. While they were yet talking. Does not that look very much like chapter 6, verse 1? At the very moment that they're speaking about these things, the king's eunuchs arrive and hustle Haman off to the feast that Esther had prepared. The balloon with Zeresh's words in it, like a cartoon, are still hanging in the air when the eunuchs walk in and say, time to go to the feast. Pop. What do you think Haman's thinking about as he's heading off to the feast? As he's being hustled off from his home to the palace, the contradiction in him is palpable. The contradiction is palpable. On the one hand, he's just been told by his wife, you better back off. This Mordecai is going to take you down. And it would appear, based on the way that Haman responds, his hatred for Mordecai only grows, not shrinks. And at the same time, he's being hustled off to the palace in order to go to a feast of which he would consider it a great honor to go. Right? Esther is the queen, after all, and he has been invited to go to the feast along with the king. Wow! Remember, he himself bragged about that earlier to this same wife. So, here you have this palpable contradiction in the man. I hate this Mordecai. Hey, I'm going to see Esther. I'm going to get honored. I hate this guy who got honored. Oh, I'm going to get honored. I love it. Now, the feast lasts for 2 days. I think this is out of custom. But there's another reason I think maybe the feast lasted for 2 days, and it's, I think, maybe Esther knowing that this is what it takes to limber up the king. Okay, a couple days of feasting and drinking and, well, you fill in the rest. Esther knows the gravity of what she's about to do, okay? She needs the king in a right state of mind, okay? So she's not going to just spring it on him, which she could have done, by the way. Remember when he initially held out the scepter to her and said, come in, and she didn't. Remember, she just said, I want to have a feast, and I want to invite you and Haman to the feast. And so she's biding her tongue. She's looking for just the right moment because she knows about the gravity of what she's about to do. But she also knows there is danger here. Now, you must not forget this. The danger here is going up against Haman. The man does possess power. Yes, he might have been humiliated by his having to, you know, lead Mordecai through the city square, but he does have power. And in fact, where his real power lies is in his rage. His real power lies in the fact that he hates this Mordecai. Now, so Queen Esther knows that going up against Haman is dangerous. And so she needs to be very careful about how she approaches this in order to disarm Haman and get what she needs from the king. And by the way, you could even argue that there's danger from the king here, because you can almost imagine her going to the king and saying, hey, guess what? I'm a Jew. I'm a Jew too. What? Okay, so she knows
there's danger lurking in the situation. So she allows this to go for a couple of days. But on the second day, then the king comes to her and says, what would you like? I will give you anything you wish, even up to half of my kingdom. Now, I think that's a way of saying, I'll grant you whatever you wish, even if such a request seems unreasonable. All right, that's really another way of saying that. I'll give you up to half of my kingdom. Can't give away your own kingdom. That's not possible. But what you can do is say, I'll give you whatever you want, even if it seems unreasonable. I think the meaning of this, in terms of him reaching out to her, is saying this: surely you desire something, Queen Esther, and I am prepared, either by drink or by love, to grant it to you. I'm willing to give you what you want. Do not withhold your thoughts or your desires. So in a way, the king sort of puts her in the predicament of having to finally tell the king what she desires. Now again, don't forget, the king knows she wants something. She came into his presence. She had the nerve, the unmitigated gall, if you will, to walk into his presence, even though he hadn't called for her for 30 days, right? And came in not all dressed into the nines, but rather looking rather like she'd been fasting for 3 days. And so he knows she wants something. So now he's put her in the position of actually having to make her request. Time's up. Time's up. So Esther simply requests that the king spare her people and her with them. Look how she says it. She says, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, verse 3, chapter 7, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me. Notice how that's phrased. Let me give my very life in this request for my wish and my people for my request. First, she honors the king by asking this only if it pleases the king, which she obviously does. So now she says, now if it pleases you, he has put out, you know, go ahead. And so he says, okay, if it pleases you. So she's being careful here in how she words this. She's standing before an emperor, right? A man who can, you know, so she knows. So she says, now look, if it's okay by you, if you know, if you don't have any objections to this, if it honors you. And then she informs the king that her people, and by her, and her by extension, have been scheduled for genocide. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Okay, so she informs the king that she and her people, now notice she includes herself. She remembers what Mordecai said. Remember what Mordecai said to her? You will not escape just because you're in the palace. In fact, I think that's a veiled way of Mordecai saying, listen, if you don't reveal it, I'll reveal it, and you're going to be caught up in all this. So it's better for you to actually admit that you belong to a certain people and to say that that whole people, including yourself, has been scheduled for annihilation. Okay? That helps, by the way, in making the argument. Then she goes on to say, She goes on to say, if we had been sold merely as slaves, if we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss of the king. And there's a couple of things that she says there. First, she is implying that the king has been tricked by a bribe. We have been sold. Okay, so this was an act of bribery or selling off of an entire people through some sort of economic bribe of some sort. And then secondly, she appeals to the king on an economic basis. Now, I wrote here probably a bit of an overkill. Okay. But look, if you're going to make the argument, make it all the way. What she says, if the Jews had simply been sold into slavery, the king would continue to benefit and she would have remained silent. There's no reason for her to be overly concerned about them simply being sold into slavery. Why? Because they're already exiles. But the economic loss to the king would have been great had they been killed off. Okay, that's what she's saying. She's saying, if we'd just been sold, nothing really would have changed. But we haven't been sold to just be slaves. We've been sold to be annihilated. We've been sold to be genocidally done away with. Now, this is exactly the exact opposite argument that Haman himself made. What did he say to the king? Remember? These people don't provide any economic reality to you, no economic benefit to you. If they're wiped out, it won't matter to you. You won't lose anything. That was one of his chief arguments. But she turns it around and says, oh, no, these people are very valuable to you because they're a part of your kingdom. They do provide a great economic value to you as the king. So what Esther does here is she reveals her true identity and ethnicity. Here's where it comes. This is the moment in which she now casts her lot in with the rest of her people so that they know her. So that the king now knows who she really is. It all comes down to this point. Will the king accept or reject her? Will the king reject her or not? She's staking. You will notice the way she makes this argument. She's staking it upon herself. I have been sold along with these people. But in doing so, she has to reveal that she's a member of them. In this case, it appears the king overlooks her ethnicity and becomes angry over the fact that someone has tricked him. Someone has dared to do this. Who has dared to do this? Notice he does not focus on her ethnicity, but rather immediately goes to who has tricked me. I do believe that this is a very strong picture of the grace of God over Esther. Sure, she now reveals who she is, but the king doesn't care. The king's more worried about being bribed. Fascinating. And you remember I said last week that the principle that comes out of this, and this is the principle that really revolves in the book very much, is that we as believers need to be ready and willing to identify ourselves with the people of God. In a world and in a culture that hates Christians, we need to be quick to identify, even if that means persecution or opposition. Thus, the revelation has been made. Esther turns and says, it's this one, this enemy, this foe. And you can almost see the blood drain out of Haman's face right in the text. He's terrified. He is now the direct enemy of Esther and her people. He is now the direct enemy of Mordecai and his people. And he is now the direct enemy of the king himself. What a bad day Haman's having. The king walks out, going to verses 7 to 10. The king walks out in anger. Haman stays behind to plead for his life before Esther. I suspect that the king leaves because he needs some time to think about what he's going to do. What do I do here in the face of this situation? But Haman has to beg for his life before a woman he thought a few minutes ago was his respecter. Right? He thought he was being honored by the woman when he came to the feast. And now he finds himself in the opposite position. She is the one he needs to beg to. And of course, again, another humorous incident in the book. You can almost see God laughing here. The king walks back in at the very moment that Haman is throwing himself on the couch that Esther is reclining on, begging. And what does he assume? He even wants my wife. And so, some men who are clever and who know about the fact that Haman has created a gallows come in and say, hey, the man built a gallows, why don't you use those? And the king says, string him up. And the very gallows that he himself had built, Haman is hung on. Now, what do we do with this? What do we do with this text? You know, there's a number of little sub-applications along the way, but I couldn't help but think about all these various twists and ironies and comedies and so on that are all scattered throughout this text and how well it all kind of meshes together. And I spent some time, I must confess, it took me a while to figure this out. I figured it out while being at the camp, of all places. And here's what I thought about.
as I was listening to the boys talk about the circumstances of their lives and listening to the preaching and being involved in all the various things that were going on, here's the thought that came to my mind. Not all circumstances in life are as they appear. And not everything is how we think it is. So very often we think, for example, that many of the circumstances in our lives that are awful, we think those things are things that need to be done away with. Get rid of that. And then there are other times when we think that when the circumstances of our life turns good and we look at those things, we think, ah, this is what the Lord desires for me. When in fact, we may have that exactly backwards. Maybe the Lord's decided that the circumstances of your life are designed for a purpose exactly opposite of what you think it's for. What if God has decided that the evil that's come into your life, whatever it might be, disease or suffering of some sort or whatever, is designed to be good? Designed to be what God purposes for you to have so that He can teach you something. What if all the circumstances of your life, what if all the problems that you're struggling with are all just simply God asking for your attention? Because you see, when it's in the good times when we don't need God, so we don't care if He's knocking. Here's what's fascinating. Brother Carey was preaching from Revelation 3:20. And there's an irony in Revelation 3:20. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door. He doesn't say, hear my knocking. He says, hear my voice. See the contrast? Our lives are filled up with a lot of knocking. But are we hearing the voice of the one who's calling? Are we really looking at our circumstances and seeing them what God has designed them for? Or are we spending our life whining? As though we're the one that's supposed to be dragging Mordecai around the city square and feeling bad about it. What if God has purposed for your circumstances that He is providentially ordering, sovereignly controlling, if we really believe that, what if those circumstances are being designed by God to get your attention and to bring you closer to Him? Or, to say it as I said it earlier, to take your eyes off of you and get your eyes on Him. And I believe that our God is more than happy to fill your life up with misery to get your attention. If you don't believe me, read Hebrews 12. The fact of the matter is, the one that God loves, He disciplines to keep fast to Himself. Don't gnash your teeth at the circumstances of your life. Maybe those circumstances are designed to pull you closer to a God who loves you enough to say, I love you just the way you are, but I love you too much to leave you the way you are. Haman never learned the lesson, and it cost him his life. Let us, as true followers of Christ, keep our eyes fixed upon this Christ and learn the lesson. Do not forsake the discipline of the Lord. Let's pray. Indeed, Father, this is such a wonderful story of your sovereignty, worked out by your providential hand, governing the events of the life of Haman and the king and Esther and the others. We thank you for providentially carrying this story down to us, that it might remind us that you are the one who ultimately is in control of all things, and you do with men as you will. You turn the heart of the king in whatever direction you desire. And so, Father, my prayer is simple this morning. Help us to face our circumstances, not with grumbling and humiliation, but rather to face our circumstances and look to Christ Jesus, our Lord. If you have blessed us with good, if you have given us good times and prosperities, then, Father, may we not grow apathetic, but rather may we even more diligently pursue after what you, who you are. And if you have ordained miseries into our lives, Father, may we learn the lessons of them. You are the God who has ordained all these things into our life. And while we certainly can come before you and pray that you would remove them, the simple fact is that you, as God, although able to take them from us, are the one who has ordained them in our lives. May we glorify this Jesus. May we glorify him in our circumstances. May we see the lessons we ought to see as you guide us through this life. And may Jesus Christ be praised as we keep our eyes fixed upon him and make him the true object of our affections. So we ask these things that you would do, not because we deserve them, but because Jesus Christ is our advocate at your side. And in his name we pray.